Welcome to Ready, Set, Practice, Insight for New PAs, the podcast designed to help you navigate the transition from PA student to clinical practice. I'm Dr. Jennifer Orozco-Cole, the Chief Medical Officer at the American Academy of Physician Associates. And today's episode tackles an important question for every new PA: who decides what you get to do? While your education and training prepare you to provide exceptional patient care, the reality of practice is shaped by federal and state laws, facility policies, and payer regulations. That's why it's critical for PAs to understand and own their scope of practice. And to help us break it all down today, we're joined by Dr. Megan Fulton, who is the Enterprise Executive Director of Advanced Practice Providers at MUSC Health in Charleston, South Carolina. She is also a professor at the MUSC PA program and clinically practices in primary care. She also happens to serve as the legislative chair for the South Carolina Academy of Physician Associates. So, Dr. Fulton, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jen. It's so nice to be here with you.
I'm so glad you're here with us. So why don't you start by telling our listeners just a little bit about yourself and maybe your journey as a PA?
That sounds good. Well, I graduated PA school in 2007, and my first job was in the emergency department. It was an exciting time diving in as a newbie, as you know, we're talking about today on what that looks like, and what looked like that back many years ago looks very different today. There's so many changes in law, legislation, and so forth, and I can't wait to talk to you about that today. My journey began, again, in emergency department and then evolved into the trauma team. I really wanted to get my hands dirty. And as a young PA, I loved hands-on medicine, surgery, fast-paced life. And as that evolved, two things happened. We started to think about different opportunities within our state organization, SCAPA, and how to really get involved at a different level other than clinical medicine. So I started hosting dinners in the Lowcountry, which was wonderful for networking with other PAs. And that led to other real big dreams of wanting to look into health administration. And so as my journey began through clinical medicine, at the same time, there were positions that were being created within the hospital to look at leadership. And so I became one of the first APP leads on the trauma team. And then as I moved over into neurosurgery, that happened yet again. And so the opportunities within administration and healthcare were growing at MUSC. And in 2016, I took the director of PA practice, and I have never looked back. It's been 9 years. The center is growing. I'm now the system executive director for 900 APPs across our 17 hospitals. Wow. We have roughly 1,543 physicians. And we bring such a wonderful culture here at MUSC, working with our physician partners. It has been incredible to see the mission really grow and all of the access to care opportunities really flourish within our health system.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Tremendous. And as someone who also has been along that journey over the years, as PAs and APR instructors grew within hospitals and health systems, I know very much what you went through and sort of where you are now. So tell me, you're this healthcare administrator, leader, executive now, and you obviously have a lot of new graduates that come into the organization. So tell me, what do you want new graduate PAs to understand about the different layers of the rules? So whether it's federal, whether it's state, whether it's facility, and what do you want them to know about how that defines their scope of practice? And maybe let me say, we define our scope of practice. However, we are limited by these federal, state, and facility policies that exist and maybe a lot of people don't know about. So tell me what you would want a new graduate PA to know and understand.
That's a great question, because when you think about scope of practice, that aligns with what we can do with patients at the bedside. What opportunities are there to grow into? For example, procedures that you may not have been taught or have been taught and need more experience. And so there's so many ways to grow in our scope and span of control and working with our patients at the bedside. What I would say is that the law, policies, all these things are very complex. But at the end of the day, as a PA, you have to know them and you have to know where to find them. So if you don't have a local APP leader or a director or chief of advanced practice, then it's really easy to think about the concepts of the law. If you think about how the laws cascade, which you and I talk about a lot, it is federal at the top, which is the pie in the sky, the most liberal laws out there. But when you think about our state law, which for every state, PAs have a practice act, that can be more conservative than federal law. And then after that, you have to look at Board of Medical Examiner advisories, which are interpretations of the law for which one should follow in practice. And then as you enter that big health system, you'll find that those bylaws, rules, and regulations that can even stymie even that state law. And so what's really important as a PA and as a future leader is to really look at the alignment between the bylaws, rules, and regulations that the hospitals create versus your state law. And to achieve alignment with those two will really unlock seamless practice. So that is the overview of the law. And then not to mention something like policy tech. Where does your hospital and health system manage all policies for their health system? And this can be a policy for CAUTI, CLABSI, any of the medical procedures that are out there that a lot of nurses have driven these policies. And so ask your local nurse manager. They will know where to find it. And to review all those early on, the first few weeks would be something to really understand.
Yeah, that's such a key takeaway is to ask, right? And, you know, when you have a, and if we use your organization as a great structure, people are lucky that work for your organization. They have someone to go to, right? There's leaders and managers and others above them. And you say, where do I find this? And I don't understand these complexities. And so ask, and it's really critical that, you know this and that it really is part of who you are as a clinician, you know, and we have a lot to get through today, but I want to mention one thing is when new grads come out, and I've seen this happen a lot. I've heard people say, well, I don't need to know those things because, oh, I can just rely on the collaborating physician that I work with, you know. That person or individual will tell me what I can and cannot do. And the reality is most of them have no idea about your scope of practice. They understand their own scope of practice, right? And physicians are very different than PAs, but we have a lot of overlap. So what do you say to new grads who say, oh, I'll just, you know, wait and see what somebody tells me I should do, when in fact, it really is your responsibility to know and to understand your scope.
Yes, when it comes to scope of practice for PAs, I would say the first thing is that document that you have on file or may not have on file with the state board, you have to have in your personal files. You have to keep up with all of your licensure, all the payments, so that none of those lapse. We've had cases where PAs lapse their license, lapse their certification, and we have to pay back money to the insurance company for those patients for which that PA saw on a lapsed license. That is never good. So that's the first piece of the pie. I would say relating to the collaborating physician, our physician partners have their own scope, like you said, Jennifer. And so we have our own scope, and there is some flexibility within that scope and scope interpretation. It's really important to understand what that means from a basic legal standpoint. How many drugs can you prescribe? What drugs can you prescribe? How often can you prescribe? Do you need some sort of attestation from the physician if you prescribe more than 3 doses of IV medications? Those are all very important questions. And for some state organizations, they have created an FAQ document to interpret the law in layman's terms to guide you. But yes, you're right. I would say that there are a lot of different areas within the hospital that will try to interpret PA law, and I've seen many mistakes come from that. So the best form of information gathering would be to contact your local state constituent organization. For us, it's SCAPA, and find the legislative chair who can guide you to the right resources, essentially, and even provide some interpretation. So I say go back to the state constituent organization all the time. We are beautifully set up as PAs. Every state has one, and that rolls up to AAPA. So when you talk about support from the central office where you are from and that you lead, Jennifer, it is a wonderful, most accurate dialogue that we can have back to AAPA if there's a question as well on the law. But go back to your state.
Absolutely. And I appreciate that, Megan. And I think, you know, that what I'm hearing is really this importance of you are accountable and your own responsibility for your professional license, your board certification, you name it, it's on you to remember and to know where to find it and who to reach out to if you don't know next steps, but really is on you as a clinician to maintain all of those things. So such good advice. So let's talk about policies, facility policies and procedures. So what I mean, there's so many, right? If I pulled, and I go back to my old academic hospital, if I pulled the policies, you know, I go online and I find them, there's thousands of policies in there. Like, where do I look in the policy and procedures manual, website, you name it? Like, what pertains to me as a PA, and where the heck do I, how do I navigate this, and how do I find it?
Yes. So each health system will have a credentialing and regulatory office. And so a lot of those policies go through what's called the medical staff or MEC, Medical Executive Staff Committee. That governing body is a lot of your top physicians, your CMO, CNO. I have a seat on our medical staff committee. And so they house and change a lot of those procedures. There's usually a hub or an app within your health system that will essentially house all of those. But what would be good is for you to research and ask your seasoned APP colleagues and physician leaders, what are the typical policies that we really need to follow on the inpatient floor or on the outpatient side? And this is where team-based care really becomes alive. Your nursing counterparts who are running the floors and who are managing these clinics, your practice managers are a wealth of information and can guide you into these policies. But, you know, one of the policies I think about is, and I just gave a lecture, Jen, last week to our PA students here at MUSC, is do I have enough time at the end of the day to get my notes done? And I said, you better make time at the end of the day to get your notes done, because you don't want to wait too many days, because you may forget what you even prescribed or which leg hurt, which back part of the back. And so you want to get your notes done. Usually there's a 14-day clause. And if you don't hit that end clause, then the practice cannot assume reimbursement from the insurance company for those patient visits. And then you, as a new grad, become a cost center instead of a revenue generating center. You want to bring collections, bring finances to the health system so the health system can grow, pay your salary, and build more medical buildings, because we know access to care is has many challenges right now.
Yeah, no, it's such good advice. And, it, you know, not to remember that, yes, you are a clinician first and foremost, but we still also have the professional practice of medicine and the business of medicine. And I used to tell all of my PAs and APRNs, I still have to keep the lights on. So, you know, we need to figure out that balance. And I used to tell the students, or not the students, the PAs, everyone, try to document in real time if you can. And, you know, there's a lot of new tools on the market. There's a lot of AI, and that could be a whole nother podcast episode in itself. But really figuring out how do you, you know, practice in the moment and make sure, because that's the best, you know, from a quality safety standpoint in terms of documentation. So let's move a little bit. I want to talk about restriction. This is how restrictive policy or policy interpretation, that is incorrect. This is actually how I got my start in advocacy for PAs 20 plus years ago. I was and quick story is I was a vascular surgery PA and was for many, many years. But early in my career, I was in the clinic and we had a patient that I had operated on with the surgeon, and I was taking out sutures and staples of that patient in the clinic. And there was an individual who threatened to report me saying I was practicing out of scope because only nurses were allowed to remove sutures and staples and physicians. And that was it. And, you know, that went to some higher ups and they said, oh, yeah, we don't think PAs can do this. And thus my journey began of looking into show me the policy. Right. It was my favorite thing. People used to say, it's a policy that you can't do that. And which was usually followed up by from me, show me the policy that says that I can't do that and prove otherwise. So tell me a little bit, because, you know, PAs are well known and they're essential parts of healthcare systems, but this still exists. So maybe you could share an example of where this happened, sure. Where a PA who knew their education and skill set allowed this, but there was something internal that was either a policy that didn't exist or someone's misinterpretation that didn't allow them to do it. And what the heck do you do when you're a new grad? How do you speak up? So,
yeah. Oh, there are so many different examples. I'll take one example though, and this is why we in this session this year will be changing some of our prescriptive authority verbiage. We had an APP write a patient cancer medication appropriately. The patient went to the pharmacy, attempted to fill the prescription. It was a scheduled pain medication. They have cancer. And the pharmacist refused to fill it because they thought that the APP filled it incorrectly. And what's a little bit interesting, it's twofold, is the pharmacist cannot interpret how we prescribe. It is actually against the law. So if that APP were to call the pharmacist, they could reference that piece of the law where here is the prescriptive authority in our scope, and here is why you shouldn't interpret. And that patient could have had their script, you know, within a couple hours if we would have known that. Not all of us are equipped to say, hey, here's the law, here's where you should interpret. But this is where it is so helpful, right? Because it's written down somewhere. And so when you think about scope of practice, it is in the law. And, you know, as many times as I read the law, I still have to go back and highlight the sentence or two on where prescriptive authority lives. And I feel like I'm reading the same thing five times. But right. That's how complex it can be. So really understanding those bullets is important. But there's so many other examples. Usually the calls that we get are from the OR, the operating room, where they think that a PA is practicing outside of their scope because they're, you know, handling a procedure when the attending may not be around. But, you know, we know that in certain cases, the attending physician has to be in key portions of those cases. And then a PA can do some of those other things while the attending is perhaps across the room or coming back from another case. So, but I guess the point being, right, is to not have fear and be confident in what you're doing. And take a deep breath and find that policy, provide that education, and also give that person who is trying to report you grace. Because at the end of the day, their intentions are to protect patient safety. And so as a new PA, it feels confrontational when this is very typical for our practice as you gain years of experience is to protect the patient. So thank them, educate them. And that is a great way to sort of rebuild and develop trust in that relationship. Whereas if you were to respond in a different way, you could create a separation and not a great team environment. So always give people the better, you know, the better hand there.
Yeah. Oh, Dr. Fulton, such great advice, and is something that is hard to do, especially when you're emotional, right? When you first start out in practice. But really controlling those emotions and having that emotional intelligence to always take it from a place of people don't know what they don't know, and take a deep breath and move forward and helping people understand and educate. Such good advice there. So, and I think as we wrap up here, and this was such a great piece of advice, what maybe is something, one piece of advice that you can give to new PAs about balancing their work life? It's a struggle being a new grad, right? I mean, you're trying to learn so many things, you're trying to be this great clinician, but you also have this life outside of your work and your career. So what is some new advice that you give new graduates on how do you find some balance? And you can't know everything. So how do you find that as a new grad?
I think that's a great question. And I think our core values change over time and with experience in different phases of our life, whether you're a new PA at 22 or you're a PA at 42, leading organizations. I think, it's important to understand what those shifts are looking like for your family, for your friends, for your neighbors, whoever your inner social circle is. And so you will always have work, and I hope you will always find meaning in your work. And so the work-life balance is at work, find meaning, find purpose, find efficiency within your work, advocate for efficiency and improvement always. Don't just settle for the status quo. I think that's where PAs really can think outside the box and make a big difference and sort of become that go-to person from an efficiency standpoint and really step into their leadership journey. On the flip side, if you have a partner, you're married, you have children, fur babies, whatever, you have a church group, whatever your social circle looks outside of that, you want to maintain that and also pour into that as well. And so it may be really intentional date nights with your husband, your partner. It may be dedicated, playtime with your family. And so, always being very honest with your family and your friends on sort of what you're going through at work is really helpful. It helps to connect those shared values, but it also helps us to feel more human, and to connect with those who we love. Work-life balance, as we say here at MUSC, is more like work-life harmony. It always changes. There's always harmonization, and not necessarily balance. But keeping in mind why we're PAs, we are treating disease, but we should also focus on prevention of disease. I'm a big wellness guru, preventative health advocate. And so focusing on your nutrition, exercise, sleep, and your relationships will progress you into a state where you can very much take care of patients. And as you become a leader, which I hope you all consider and become and are energized to do, you also have to create that psychological safety and that mental space to take care of your own APP managers and administrators. It also helps you collaborate kindly. So that you are building relationships, you are building relationships interdisciplinary style. So nursing, PT, OT, nurse practitioner, physician, social worker. The team is essential to how you go about your day. And if you can really gel and make amends with a team and figure out how to navigate personalities and navigate what works for them, you again become a natural leader because you're like the glue holding this together, but also a safe space for people that may be having trouble at work. So.
Yeah, such good, Meg, such good advice. And I love your concept and idea of work-life harmony. And with that, I'm going to ask you our final question, which is finish, and I should say statement, finish this statement, Meg. When I'm not at work, I am probably.
I am probably cooking. Right now, I'm probably trying to mess with my sourdough starter on the counter, for which my husband says I've spent way too much money on organic flours. Why don't you just buy the darn bread? And I said, well, that's not my nature. You gotta bake this bread. It's a science experiment. So I've really learned over the past year to make some really good sourdough bread, which I slice. and put in the freezer and have it all day long. So that's what I'm doing now.
I love it. There's that harmony. It's so such good advice. Well, you know that, and thank you for being here. And that wraps up this episode of Ready, Set, Practice. Understanding your scope of practice is one of the most important things you can do as a new PA, and taking ownership of that knowledge will set you up for success. A huge thank you to Dr. Megan Fulton for sharing her expertise. And if today's discussion resonated with you, take action, review your facility's policies, understand your state regulations, and don't be afraid to advocate for your role within the healthcare system. For more resources and professional development opportunities, visit Learning Central, where you can also claim CME for this episode. And if you found this episode helpful, be sure to subscribe and share with your fellow PAs. So until next time, keep learning, keep growing, and keep shaping the future of PA practice.